Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, and welcome to Medieval Lols, a close reading series from the London Review of Books. I'm Mary Wellesley.
And I'm Irina Dumitrescu.
And we're both writers, literary historians, and contributors to the paper. In this series, we're asking, was the Middle Ages funny? And to answer that today, we're looking at a series of 13th or 14th century old French tales about bed tricks and hijinks. These are, of course, the fabliaux. We should say at the top that this episode contains fairly graphic discussion of sexual themes. Okay, Irina, let's start. What are the fabliaux?
So the fabliaux are short, witty tales in verse. That's the basic definition of them. There are about 160 or so of them in French, mostly anonymous, from the north or northwest France. And, you know, they're being written between the 12th and 14th centuries and gathered in big manuscript collections of them. And they tend to feature quick-witted, spry characters. There's a lot of trickery. There's a lot of cleverness. There's quite a bit of debate. And the thing that really distinguishes them as a genre is that they're very interested in physical things. They're interested in bodies, in sex, and in money. So a lot of the characters are often lower class, and they're supposed to have a kind of rustic, you know, interest in the material aspects of life. Scholars have had various kinds of theories over the ages. They used to, you know, think that the audience of the fabliaux must have been lower class because who else could sully their ears with such sexual material and such rude topics? Then they decided maybe it's actually upper class people who enjoy listening to stories about peasants discussing rude topics. And I think now the idea is more that there is probably a mixed audience, and who knows, you know, maybe also urban audiences, merchants, all kinds of people might have enjoyed these. It's a little bit silly to assume one rank of person likes witty and or filthy material more than another. But that's what we have. What we have are the stories.
Yeah. And so listeners who've heard the first episode of this series, you know, the Miller's Tale, Chaucer's Miller's Tale, that's a really perfect example in English of an English writer taking this very well-established form from Old French and kind of reusing it in Middle English. So listeners may have come across these kinds of texts before, but in their kind of English manifestation, or if they've read any Boccaccio, you know, Boccaccio also used this kind of form a lot and put them into these kind of large collections in a sort of different and quite literary way, but nonetheless the basic form is there. It's the kind of, I would say it's the sort of tabloid journalism of
Well, I'm struggling to think of a genre that's like that today exactly, but you know, are they the TikToks of the, I don't know. I mean, Chaucer's Reeve's Tale is also based on a French fabliaux, so it's, you know, they're quite, I think they're definitely funny. We can get that out of the way. You know, I hope we can convey that in today's episode. But they're also very tightly crafted. We saw that in the Miller's Tale, where one event sets off all kinds of other events, like dominoes. That's part of the aesthetic pleasure of these, that they're aware of language and the plotting is very well considered. So there's not a lot of space for accidental materials. And that also makes it fun to read because you can actually ask the questions like, what is this doing here? Why is this detail here and not another?
Yeah, and to just kind of jump in there without completely butchering the comedy to death. But, you know, if you just think about the form, these are generally octosyllabic couplets. And so it's quite a kind of, it's a springy little line that doesn't leave a lot of space for kind of, you know, word, you know, pointless sort of lexical clutter. Like the you know, you kind of really get to the point quite quickly. And so the form really suits often the topics that are being discussed, because a lot of it is sometimes really quite wonderfully graphic description of things that are going on often in beds or in other locations.
So why don't we jump right into
let's jump right in
a fabliaux. This is you know, the they have different titles depending on what the editors have given them as a title. But this fablio that we'll talk about today is called La Damoiselle qui n'oit parler de fautre, qui n'os mal au cœur, which Nathaniel Dubin, who is our translator and editor for today, has a big, big collection of fablio, really wonderful to read, calls The Maiden Who Couldn't Abide Lewd Language, which I find funny because he's already cleaned it up in the title. It's actually The Maiden Who Could Not Stand to Hear a Fucking without getting sick. So this is where we begin. So why don't we tell the story?
Okay, so we have a young woman, and they're clearly quite well off. They're clearly quite well off. They're able to afford household help, domestic servants, but she says that she just can't abide having any servants in the house because then they would just constantly talk about fucking, basically, and, you know, or cock or balls, etc., is the wonderful translation. And so she says, you know, we just can't have people like that in the house. I can't hear it. And so they're forced to look after themselves within the house. So already the first joke, like, imagine how terrible for these fancy people that they are having to clean their own house or whatever.
And do all the yard work and so on. So there's a little bit of a class joke there already, right? That the peasants or the rustics, the lower classes, just call a spade, and the upper classes need some kind of special language, right? They need a more elaborate, euphemistic language. But it's also kind of weird because she seems to be calling the shots, right? Dad just does what she says. Mm-hmm. There's no mother here. She just says, well, you know, it makes me sick. It's not even that she doesn't enjoy, she doesn't like it, or that she's offended. She becomes physically ill. And so you think she's going to be like the 13th century of a snow version of a snowflake, you know, that she's not going to be able to withstand much at all. That turns out not to be the case. But
I mean, it's a long-standing erotic trope, right? You know, the seemingly tentative maiden who doesn't seem very keen, but turns out actually she is. Spoiler alert, listeners.
So into this context comes a young man, David, who is clever and charming, and he arrives in town and he's just trying to find some way to get some cash or some food. And he hears about this young woman and about her father and this ridiculous situation they have where the father has to do all of the work in the hot sun on his own. And he asks for work. And the father basically says, well, you know, I can't because my daughter can't stand to hear these words, which David pretends to be just as fragile as she is and starts saying, oh, no, please, you know, don't say anything like that. I can't. I get sick even at the thought.
And then we have this wonderful moment in which David announces, you know, all the things that he's able to do. He's, you know, he can plow and he can plant, he can thresh, he can winnow. And probably the attentive listener at this point, because we're probably imagining that these texts were performed. Kind of oral performance to them.
Group.
Perhaps someone reading aloud and people, you know, joking. There's a sort of social element to the way in which these texts are received. And so already, you know, the plowing and the winnowing, you know, perhaps you might see the innuendo here already. So then David is then employed by this man.
But can I just say, it's actually the daughter. Even here, it's the daughter who runs out and says, we have to hire this man. Because maybe she's fallen for the trick, but this is the one man who seems to be as squeamish about dirty language as she is. So she's finally found her guy. And then, just to make it a little odder, when they have to bed him for the night, the father doesn't quite know where to put him. And the daughter says, well, he can share my bed with me, or he can sleep with me. Maybe it's in the same room and so on. Dad seems okay with the situation. So he puts David in the room with his daughter. And then David doesn't really lose any time in acting, does he?
No. So his first act, as we're told, is to place his hand on her bare bosom. And he asks her, well, what is this called?
Because he doesn't know any dirty words. How would he know what breasts are called?
And she says, well, you know, they're my breasts, so white and fair, and in no way shameful or unclean. So then he slides his hand down between her legs, below the abdomen, as the translation decorously puts it. The hole one puts one's penis in, it then goes on to say. And he felt the first hairs newly growing, all soft and silky, barely showing. Exploring with his right hand, he again asks what that thing might be.
And she tells him it's her pasture, which is not much overgrown. So I guess there's not, or in the French, it's not flowered yet. It hasn't flowered yet. She's clearly post-pubescent. We get that sense from the description of her pubic hair. So, you know, she would be old enough to have sex, but she hasn't had sexual experience yet. But she also doesn't seem particularly upset that his hand is there.
Exactly. And he says, and here in the middle of your fine meadow, what's this puddle, this slippery, soft, ditch-like thing?
And she calls that her spring, which is not yet overflowing. There's not yet fluid coming out of it the way there should be out of a spring. But it goes on. Davy continues exploring.
And then he says, and can you tell me what's ensconced down here?
And this is one of my favorite parts. Maybe I'll read it in the French as well as the English. C'est les corneres qui la garde. Faites la pucelle pour verte. Ce best entroite de dans mon pré pour boivre en la fontaine claire. Tantost corneroit les corneres pour faire l'honte et peur. Why, that's the bugler, Davy dear, the maiden says, who's standing sentry. If man or beast sought to gain entry and try to drink from my clear spring, the sentry would start trumpeting and strike his heart with fear and shame. All right. Can we pause here for a moment before we go on?
Yep.
What's going on?
Well, I think what's very interesting is that, as you say, this appears to be a consenting encounter, right, in which he is asking her about these parts of her body and asking her to describe them in her own terms. And that's quite, it's quite strange. I mean, of course, it is nonetheless disturbing to a modern audience that he's describing a woman who's clearly young. I mean, you know, what we today would think of as probably underage. That is, of course, disturbing, but it's unfortunately a kind of medieval trope.
But on the other hand, we've had it set up that she's in charge.
Yeah.
Right? She's in charge of her father's, you know, household. And she's in charge of hiring Davy. And she's the one who puts him in her own bedroom. So there is this weird, you know, when I first read this poem, I thought it was a setup to a rape scene.
Mm.
I thought he would trick her because she was so naive and she couldn't take the language. Mm-hmm. That he would somehow fool her into having sex. And that happens in some Fablio, right? And that it's about fooling the more innocent person mm-hmm. into a sexual encounter that they can't really consent to, right? That seems to be the setup. Here's this strange man, this woman who can't even hear, you know, the language about sexuality. He's going to trick her. But she's the one who puts him in her bed, and she is consenting the whole time. It's really, I mean, it could be, you know, a guide today to consensual sex, right? Because he's sort of asking at every stage. And she seems to be just, it's kind of odd also because, you know, today I think the advice is to teach children to use the proper, you know, really clear words for, mm-hmm. for their private parts so that they can speak about their body in a direct way and not hide what might happen to it. But she seems to be more comfortable with the metaphorical language. She just doesn't like the words for the things, but she's okay with the parts of the body themselves. And she's not ashamed at all of her vulva, of her asshole, of her breasts, of anything.
Mm.
The parts of the body themselves are not dirty.
And she's choosing how she wants to name them. I mean, yeah. I'm thinking back to that moment in Genesis where Adam names all of the creatures of the earth. And it's this great kind of act of male power and of like, you know, man's dominion over nature. And it's kind of very interesting mm-hmm. that that's being really inverted here. And, you know, she's being given the power to name these things as she, you know, and again, she's using these kind of natural metaphors, right? So this is a sort of, in a way, it's a kind of inversion of that scene from Genesis.
And then things switch. She starts to touch him. She says, well, you felt me up enough. And she starts to touch his body.
Wait, we should just pause because there's a wonderful bit where David, you know, remarks on the bugler. And he says that scurvy bugler's much to blame for seeking strife and heckling poor harmless wildlife so it won't walk on the grass.
This is a setup for something that will happen later. Okay, so then she starts to feel him up. And she grabs his prick. The narrator of the poem is not shy and has no problem. He just calls a prick a veet, you know, just uses basic words for balls and prick and all of that. And she asks him what it is, what this hard, rigid thing is, which could batter down a wall.
And he says, "Lady, that's my pony, who isn't listless, weak and scrawny, though he's not eaten for 2 days."
She moves her hands further down and she asks, "Do tell me, Davy," she goes on, "are what I feel two balls of yarn that you are keeping in your sack?"
And he says, "Why, they're two stable hands, of course, whose business is to watch my horse when grazing in another's field. They're experts, always there to shield him and stay close by when he strays."
And I think now is the point when we should say, out of all of the literature that I have ever read in any language from any time, the Fabliau are really the most detailed and realistic and precise when it comes to descriptions of sexual encounters. There is really nothing like the attention they pay to the specific, the particular stages of sex. So she then tells him, you know, "Why don't you put your pony up to pasture in my garden?"
But it's also, I just to pause one moment here, it's kind of interesting. I hadn't thought of this before, but the fact that the whole setup of this is the fact that she won't have servants in the household because they use lewd language. And then here we're having these various parts of the body described as servants themselves performing this important function.
Well, yeah, I mean, in a way, he is serving her, right? She's hired a servant, and we don't see him work in the field at all. He just goes directly to her bed.
He is working in the field.
He is working in the field. Anyway, so he gets really close to her, basically to her mound of Venus, and he's sort of on top of her. His penis is touching her. Her mound, but they haven't yet consummated it. And there's a great passage I'd also like to read in French, and then maybe you can read the English.
Yes, please, I'd be delighted.
"Dame, mes pollens muertes soient, molt en leurs grandes poignes. Va si la boivre à ma fontaine, fait-elle, maravras peor. Dame, je dote le corneor, fait avis, qui n'engrossasse les pollens de dans un trast." Celle répond, "Si l'en dit mal, bien lo bat li maréchal," Davies respond, "c'est bien dit."
And this is the English translation. "Lady, my pony's so thirsty, he's parched and really suffering. Go water him there in my spring," she says, "no need to be afraid." He answers her, "But the bugler, lady, I fear the anger of your sentry if we allow my pony entry." She answers him, "Your stable boys can beat him up if he makes noise." David replies, "Yes, I approve."
So then they have sex, and they actually repeat it 4 times. And the trumpeter, we learn, does sound his trumpet and is beaten by the two twins. And that is how the Fabliau ends. And I feel like we're getting a lot of extra detail here, Mary. I feel like this Fabliau has given, I mean, you could have, the poet could have just told us, I mean, we could have just had the penis and the vulva, right? That would have been enough for the joke to play out. Yeah. But there's, I mean, I think what's interesting is that you also have the balls.
And the asshole.
Yeah.
And the asshole repeatedly, you know, I mean, I suppose that's a kind of interesting thing about the kind of consent, right, in this text. Because it is a consenting encounter, but then you're sort of, the suggestion perhaps is that the asshole is objecting.
He's complaining.
And is just being beaten down by the balls of yarn. or the servants, however you want to see them. And so it's kind of interesting if we do then see them as the servants, which is the metaphor that he, because she says, are these balls of yarn? And he says, no, those are servants. So it's kind of, it, you know, for the whole bit at the beginning about there being no servants in this household and whether this is, I mean, this is obviously a satire about sex, but is it also a satire about class? And the idea is, you know, the servants are getting their revenge.
Oh, yeah. I take that. And I also think, you know, at the beginning, we didn't describe this, but at the beginning of their encounter, her beauty is described.
Mm.
And it's described in really kind of standard romance terms. She's, you know, she's pale
like
and beautiful.
Blossom,
you know, she's gorgeous and so on. And we end on her farting during sex, right? And I think that's very deliberate. You know, there's a sense that a body is still a body. It doesn't matter how precious she is about her language. In the end, her body will have certain functions, and those, and she can't really necessarily control those. She can just be okay with them, and he can be okay with them too. So there's something actually, I think, in that slightly, you know, maybe like a little bit grotesque or gross final detail of their sexual encounter. I mean, they're having fun. It's a consensual. They had foreplay. They have a lot of sex. Both of them are fine with it. But there's this sense, I mean, sex is a little bit dirty and gross sometimes, right? And that's just part of the story. They have the language for it. They've put it into the story of their sexual encounter.
Yeah, I suppose I do feel a little bit like ultimately she's the one that we're laughing at. Although it's consenting, I feel like. There's a little bit, she's kind of getting her comeuppance. She's this like stuck up woman who can't even bear to have servants in the house lest they, you know, harm her ears with their lewd language. And now, you know, she's getting rammed four times and, you know. Five times.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I kind of wonder about this because I was thinking about the fact that if she's controlling the way people speak about sex in the household, and she's controlling who's in the household. So if you think about it in another way, she's created the perfect situation to have sex without getting in trouble. Because her father thinks she's too pure even to hear the word cock, right? So she wouldn't do anything naughty, right? She's found a man who's willing to play her game, who's willing not to call a spade. He's going to talk about ponies and marshals and fountains and, you know, and he seems clever enough. I think that's the point. He seems clever enough to keep the secret. And there's not many other people in the household to hear them. So she's actually created a situation where she can have sex on her own terms. And she doesn't have to worry about it coming out and becoming public because she's controlling the language in which sex is described.
The ultimate male fantasy of the woman who appears not up for it, but actually is.
But I wonder, I mean, can we talk a little bit about what this is doing with language? I mean, what the Fabliaux are also, they're about materiality, but they're also about language. What do you think it does to the story to describe the erotic encounter in this kind of ridiculous set of metaphors?
I mean, it's so much wittier and more enjoyable that the language is euphemistic.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, actually, if this was told as a purely, you know, biology textbook type terms, it would be a much less engaging and it wouldn't have the whole sort of setup.
Yeah. It kind of picks up on the riddles we talked about last time, right? That there's something about having to work to imagine what exactly is going on at any given moment actually puts you into the scene much more than if things were simply named.
Yeah. So the fact that, you know, the bugler and initially, you're thinking, well, hang on, what is being described?
I had trouble with that at the beginning. It took a little work. And then how exactly are the marshals stopping up the, you know, stopping the buglers trumpeting?
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, I think we should also talk about the fact that they have substantial foreplay.
Yeah.
Right? That it's not one of these things where they just, you know, suddenly have sex or intercourse.
Yeah, there's a scene in Chaucer's Merchant's Tale where, I mean, I'll misquote this, but it's something like, he gan pulling up her smock and in he throng. And they're in the branches of a pear tree.
It's extremely uncomfortable.
Doesn't sound comfortable or enjoyable. And he's just immediately penetrates her. So, yeah, I mean, it's clear that this is, as you say, they have felt each other. And then there's this kind of wonderful line where his penis is kind of, as you say, up against her mound of Venus. And she's saying, you know, well, don't, don't linger in the pasture.
The,
you know,
the pony's thirsty.
The pony's thirsty. Give the pony a drink.
Yeah.
Give the pony what it needs.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
So, I mean, we just had a story about a woman's desire, again, and how she finds her own way to talk about it. We'll find something a little bit similar, though maybe more forthright, in another Fabliau called Le Jugement des Cons, which Dumas has translated as Trial by Cunt, but it could also be The Judgment of the Cunts, mm-hmm. I think would be more literal. And this begins with three sisters, all of whom are having affairs with the same man. And he's promised marriage to all of them. And they find out about the situation. And they wind up fighting each other. And their father is brought in to solve the conflict between them. How are they going to decide who gets to marry this man? I don't know why they still want to marry him. But apparently he's extremely charming. And so, you know, they have to work out this this challenge. And the father essentially sets up a kind of court, including their uncle. There's a sort of slightly strange group of older men there who are set up to decide. And they have to answer a riddle, because medieval people love riddles. Mm-hmm. They have to answer a riddle. And that riddle is?
And the riddle is, who is older, you or your cunt?
Classic question.
Classic paternal question.
Classic thing for dad and uncle to ask you about in front of a group of men from the community. Which, I mean, already is kind of great because it suggests that the vulva is separable from the woman's body, that it could have a life of its own, mm-hmm. right? And a personality of its own. They like, you know, the poets of the old English riddles we talked about last time and the poets of the Fabliau, they don't just like to focus on genitals. They like to imagine genitals as kind of being on their own and maybe having their own life story and voice to some extent. So I think this is part of the fantasy of these genres. Like, it's like the detachable penis song by King Missile, but you get it over and over again. My friend Denis Berhatovich wrote an article on Fabliau and riddles called Detachable Penises. But anyway, I'd like to mention that. Shall we talk about the answers?
Okay, so what happens in this trial? So the first daughter comes, and what's her answer?
So the first they're going to get a prize. The winner will also get a prize and a dowry. So there's a man to be won and there's money to be won. The first woman answers that her cunt is older than she is. As she says, it has a beard and I do not. So that's one answer. The second sister is asked the same question. And she says, well, my cunt has to be younger because I have teeth. And it does not. So a little bit of a suggestion of the possibility of a vagina dentata or a situation where her vulva would have teeth.
And the third?
I think we need to answer this one in French first. Mm-hmm. Oncles, dit-elle, pour nous lui ne l'aurait que ne le vous dit. Qui veut si le tienne à folie. Mais quand est plus jeune de moi, si vous direz raison pourquoi de la mamelle, suis c'est vrai, mais cons à la goule baée, jones est si veut allaiter. Or, mos j'ai bien affiché que j'ai bonne raison trouvée, l'âme de lui soit honorée qui jugera ses mots à droite.
Uncle, my cunt's younger than I, and I'll tell you the reason why. While I have been weaned from the breast, the mouth of my cunt gapes from thirst, and at its young age needs to suck. Now I will boast that I have struck on the best answer of them all. And Godspeed to the man who shall render a wise and just decision.
It's such a Georges Bataille kind of scene, you know. the idea that her cunt would still want to suck, and the word in French is allaiter, like the suck milk from the breast, right? The mind just boggles trying to imagine this situation.
Yeah, I think it's maybe good at this moment to pause and say that I think often when we think about women in the past, we often view them through the kind of lens of the 19th century, really. And we have this idea that women in the past were kind of meek and, you know, uninterested in sex and, you know, too beaten down by the structures of the church to sort of express their desire. And actually, by contrast, in the Middle Ages, there was a sort of standard trope and understanding that women were much more sexual than men and that they have a kind of insatiable erotic appetite for kind of everything. And that's one of the things that's so sort of striking about these poems is that it feels kind of radical in a way.
For
women not only to be talking about their genitals so kind of unabashedly, but also to be making jokes about them and using that for comedy within this, as you said, in this kind of male scenario, like in front of a father and an uncle. I mean, it's strange, but it's also, these are women who are very unashamed about their bodies, and that would probably strike most kind of modern listeners or readers as really remarkable.
I mean, both of our Fablio remind me a bit of the Wife of Bath, right? And I think it's because Chaucer is drawing on this tradition as well. This she talks about her vulva using various words, ma belle chose, yeah. You know, quondam. She has all of these words in different languages for her vulva, but it's a kind of richness and excess, right? Just like here, we have an excess of imagery. Mm. But I guess the question I would ask is, why does she win? Because they've all kind of given a ridiculous reason. None of the reasons are actually better than others. Why does she beat the beard and the teeth?
Because she's, well, I mean, perhaps this is a depressing answer, but she's describing the kind of the desire of the vagina, that the vagina seeks to suck and seeks to suck milk, which I think we're meant to assume is semen. So you know, the kind of the real answer is, well, of course that is what you desire more than, you know, that's the function of the vagina, right? I think that's the reason.
But it's fascinating that then these older men in her family would then just recognize that and
give her a dowry
and give her a dowry and the man. And what I also find interesting is the man, Robin, doesn't really get a say in it at the end. He's sort of, I mean, he's almost like one of these maidens at the end of a romance, you know, who's just kind of given to the warrior. Except here, it's three women, three sisters fighting each other for a man. And he doesn't get any kind of, he doesn't really consent. He's just kind of given to one as a prize, to the one with the thirstiest
cunt.
Yes, yeah. You have to at some point imagine like a breast in a vagina, right? I think he's erased it a little bit in the translation, right? Because he's making it suck, but it's allaiter. It's like a very
suckle.
Specific word. It's suckle. It wants milk, which is weird because then it suggests like the cunt is some kind of thirsty baby. Mm. Like, it's really grotesque. Mm. It's actually disturbing. That's why it's so interesting about why the fact that she wins. Mm. Like, is she the one who can gross out dad and uncle the best? Or
I mean, I think that's kind of what's great about it. It's like, oh, you've asked this like repellent question.
Here you go. Let me give you an answer. Yeah. Let me give you an answer to take home. Like, no one can say anything after this.
Yeah. I think what really strikes me about this story is that the women are being asked by their father and uncle this like incredibly sexist question, which reduces them by this very essentialist thinking to just basically walking vaginas, and they're wonderfully subverting that by using their wit to kind of turn that on its head. But of course, you know, the final story is that what a vagina really wants is a penis and some semen.
And I think that's a good place to end. Thank you, Mary.
Thank you, Irina. If you enjoy hearing about medieval literature, you can listen to our full 12-episode series, Medieval Beginnings, right now as part of the LRB's Close Readings podcast subscription, where you'll also find the whole first series of Among the Ancients with Emily Wilson and Thomas Jones, looking at classical literature from Homer to Horace, and The Long and Short with Mark Ford and Seamus Perry on 19th and 20th century literature from Tennyson to Alice Oswald. And, as well as all that, you'll be able to listen to the three new series running this year. There's On Satire with Claire Bucknell and Colin Burrow, which looks at satirical texts from Erasmus to Muriel Spark. Human Conditions with Judith Butler, Pankaj Mishra, Brent Hayes Edwards, and Adam Schatz, which looks at revolutionary texts of the 20th century. And a second series of Among the Ancients with Emily Wilson and Thomas Jones. You can listen to all of that with the Close Reading subscription. Sign up directly in Apple Podcasts or in other podcast apps. There are links for these below.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.